month's Hancock and Whitney Bank Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or any of its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email David Lundgren at HancockBank.com. That's David, D-A-V-I-D, underscore Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at HancockBank.com. If we have time, we'll take the calls. We'll take questions at the end of the call. Today I have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, with us, David Lundgren, Jeffrey Tangus, and Greg Haluski, Investment Directors. Dave, I'll go ahead and pass it on to you.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Greg, let me get started with you. Sound like a broken record. Once again, the Eurozone debt crisis issues take front page and continue to linger. Could you bring us up to date?
Sure, Dave. I saw an article this morning early, and everybody's been wondering about what the probability of not only the U.S. but also of Europe going back into recession, and Mohamed El-Erian of PIMCO came out and said that the likelihood of a Eurozone recession is going to be 50%. Really throughout the course of the month, it's just kind of been a recurring nightmare. Obviously, the problem started with Greece and then ultimately started to spread into Spain and Italy, what they call the peripheral countries of the Eurozone. European Central Bank stepped in because the yields on the Spanish and Italian bonds just went through the roof, and they began buying bonds out in the market. This seemed to help calm the markets, but it really just is a temporary fix. One of the recurring themes that I seem to notice here is that the reforms that are being implemented are really much too short-term in nature, and that I don't think investors are comfortable with the level of reform that's being implemented. Later on in the month, we began to see not only the peripheral countries getting into trouble, but then we saw it spreading to France. And France, by the way, has a AAA rating, and it's one of the major players in the European Union. The problem there was some of the French banks. Some had put it off on British reporters not being able to speak fluent French and some other misunderstandings. Also, that French banks tend to use short-term financing in their financial structure. But ultimately, if you take a look at the breakdown of foreign bank exposure to the PIG public debt, again, that's your Portugal, Italy, Spain, Greece, and Ireland. French banks have something like $100 billion worth of debt, which is far exceeds any of the other banks in Europe. Once again, I think partly later in the month, Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, and then Angela Merkel, chancellor of Germany, again held a crisis summit to see what they could do, but really little was produced out of that. And much of it was just a reiteration of enforcing existing limits and austerity measures. I think ultimately investors are dissatisfied because they're really hoping for an expansion of the bailout fund. They've got a bailout fund right now, but it's woefully, I think, inadequate to take care of the debt problems that we have in Europe. And I think I've heard the number that they need to boost that fund if they're going to use that up to like €1 trillion. So clearly right now, I think the consensus is that the plan's not working. I think the market continues to price in a default of Portugal and Greece. I guess the bottom line is that stronger countries ultimately are going to have to give support for weaker ones, and that, of course, is a point of contention when you've got Germany, which is really the workhorse engine in the Eurozone, having to bail people out. I think there's some political issues there because really the Eurozone, they've got a common monetary goal, but they don't have a mandate for a common political goal. And when you've got all these different countries competing, it's going to be tough. I think they've got some tough decisions to make. I don't want to be too pessimistic, but until we see something positive, I think we're going to continue to see spillover into our markets just as now as our growth begins to slow. Markets are kind of a hair trigger. Probably the four solutions that I've seen floated would be a total breakup in the euro, issuance of euro bonds where all the countries would back those bonds, kicking the weaker companies out, or possibly even Germany leaving, which would devalue the currency.
John, you're just getting back from traveling overseas. Any observations or any other comments that you'd like to add to Greg's?
I guess Greg covered a lot of the details of what's going on. And I was, we were traveling in the UK primarily, but of course we got quite a lot of European news, and the focus was on Germany and the probable necessity for some sort of fiscal union to take place in the U.S. to really solve this problem. And, Greg talked about some of the details involved in that, but it all seems to hinge on Germany. And that was the focus almost of all the news reports that I saw about what was happening in Europe. Germany was really the key, and they would probably step up to the plate and provide some financing of some sort, but there was always that concern about what the German public would do and whether or not they would have the the votes, in Germany for, some sort of, fiscal policy union in the Eurozone backed by Germany to really put an end to the problem. But as Greg indicated, it looked like it's going to go on for a while. But over there, the entire focus was on Germany and, the fact that they were the key to, some sort of union that might solve the problem. But, as Greg said, it looks like it's going to go on for a while and probably, remain a thorn in everybody's side as far as, the recovery is concerned and as far as the markets are concerned.
Okay, thanks, guys. Jeff, all the excitement is not limited to the Eurozone. We've had our own excitement over here in the U.S. as well. Since our last call, it seems like it's been a while ago, but since our last call, S&P downgraded the U.S. Give us your thoughts on that. I think at our last call, we talked about, what's going to happen if it did occur. Now that it's occurred, how is the world different?
Well, actually, much ado about nothing, I guess, if I had to sum it all up. Just to kind of bring everybody up to speed, S&P on August 5th, after all of the wrangling in Washington over the debt ceiling debate, the S&P downgraded the long-term rating of the U.S. sovereign debt. S&P is one of three rating services. The other two did not. And S&P had they kind of painted themselves into a corner and said if we didn't get certain things out of that debt ceiling debate and resolution from Congress that they would downgrade them. So they kind of backed themselves into a corner. So they did go ahead and downgrade the debt to AA plus from AAA. But the market actually, in the bizarro world of Wall Street, the market actually bid up prices of Treasury bonds in the wake of that. Yields went down and prices went up. And that was really because there was a flight to quality. When the U.S. Treasury gets downgraded, people assume, investors assume that the world is in pretty tough shape, and I don't think that's inaccurate, given what Greg's comments on about Europe. So people bought Treasuries, and also there was some other dynamics at work. Because portfolio managers like ourselves tend to manage large portfolios to an average quality, when your highest quality gets downgraded, if you want to maintain the same average, you have to get rid of lower quality investments, which would be junk bonds primarily, but even corporate bonds to some extent. So without getting too far into the weeds, the net effect of it was yields on Treasury securities went down, and the spreads between a Treasury and, say, an A-rated corporate bond or even a junk bond widened. So it actually had the opposite effect that a lot of people had intended. So, you know, beyond that, I guess the flight to quality and what they talk about on CNBC, which is the risk-off trade, the only other casualty of it all was they recently fired, the board fired the head of S&P. So let that be a good lesson. They do shoot the messenger sometimes.
All right, great. Thank you, Jeff. You know, we talked a little bit about the Eurozone and their problems, and I think it's, you know, pretty likely that the Eurozone countries are headed into a recession. Growth here in the U.S., I think, has really best been described as moving at stall speed. First quarter GDP was barely positive at 0.4%. And then the second quarter, the most recent reading, was right at 1%. So the economic picture remains soft. I think most economists believe the likelihood or the probability that we're heading into recession is around 30 to 40%. What are your thoughts on the economy, and are we headed into recession?
Well, you know, a lot of smart people think we're right on the fence right here. Whether you call it 30 to 40 or Muhammad Alarian at 50-50, the economy is struggling along, no question about that. It does appear that the second half of this year is going to be a little bit better than people are anticipating right now. We've seen some ISM manufacturing numbers, which indicate a positive third and fourth quarter. The issue we've got right now is consumer confidence has been beaten up so badly because of the debt debate, because of the European situation, because of the downgrade, that consumers themselves are really pretty skittish. So right now it's tough to call, but I think our official position is that we are going to skirt past the recession. We're not going to slip into recession, but it's probably going to feel a lot like a recession just because of no employment growth to speak of, whether it's modestly positive or, like the report we just got, essentially zero, or some other economic factors, the housing market still remaining soft. So the economy is likely to remain positive, but it still will feel like a recession in a lot of respects.
Don, you have anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's probably a pretty good summary. I think one thing we have to remember as we go through this period of restructuring and recovery following the crash in 2008 and the Great Recession that occurred, is that, you know, we still got all these secular headwinds, and we still have to deal with the aftermath of one of the biggest credit busts in history. And it takes, well, according to the research done by economists, these things can last anywhere from 5 to 7 years, perhaps even longer. So the problem, probably from a confidence standpoint, is the fact that we have to deal with this tremendous effort and lengthy time period to try to generate growth that, you know, looks reasonably decent, I guess, compared to what we've been used to in the past. And it's just going to take a long time to do that. I mean, if we do end up in a recession, technically, it's probably highly unlikely it'll be a recession anything like what we saw in 2008 and 2009. I mean, then you had a lot of excesses and a lot of debt problems that had to be eliminated and corrected. A lot of that is now behind us. The problem now is that we just can't really get anything started. So it's not so much that we're about to fall over a cliff. We've already done that. Now the problem is we've got to get something fairly positive started, and it might take quite some time to get that done. Relative to Europe, it looks like we're in much better shape than they are, and For what it's worth, the news reports I was getting over there indicated that same thing. You know, you see an economist interviewed, and he's a European economist. He's talking about what's going on in the world, and he would say, well, we got problems, but I said the U.S. doesn't appear to have as many problems as we do. So for whatever that's worth, I guess that's a, you know, relatively good news. But, you know, I guess it's just going to take us a while to, you know, to work through this period, and it won't feel good for a while probably, but it would be highly unlikely, I think, for us to see, you know, a really disastrous, weak economic situation at this point. It's more of, we're kind of down for the count, and we're trying to get up again.
And there was something interesting, I thought, that came out of the employment report, which got a lot of press last week, basically just because it was came out of zero, which is hard to imagine that. But if you break down the numbers, what you saw was private or corporations did actually add jobs, but they were offset by cuts in jobs at the state and local level. Now, the federal government is not cutting jobs, but state and local government, because of their fiscal pressure, are still cutting jobs. So I think it's important to remember that the private sector, corporations, are still generating good profits and are generating jobs, albeit slowly, but it is the counterbalance to that is state and local government. And there's still some of that left, but I've read some reports that indicate that may be coming to an end. So things could improve on the employment front if state and local government reaches an equilibrium point where they just either don't have to or cannot cut anymore.
Well,
Dave, I just wanted to clarify that 50% chance of a recession, that was strictly directed at the Eurozone, not at the U.S.
Gotcha. Thank you, Greg. Well, if the economy doesn't feel good, I think the S&P 500 or the stock market feels a little bit worse. But I wanted to put in perspective what's actually going in the market for our listeners. And I just jotted down some return numbers as of August 31st. We've had a couple of difficult days since then, including this morning. But as of August 31st, the market from its high in 2011, which was April 29th, was down 9.9%. So peak to trough, or I should say peak to August 31st reading, down 9.9%. Year-to-date, stocks, as reflected by the S&P 500, only down 1.8%. And if you look at the last 12 months, if you look at August 31st, 2010, to August 31st, 2011, again, it doesn't feel like it, but stocks are up 18.5% for that 12-month period. So if you just looked at the 12-month number as of August 31, you'd say, wow, what a great 12 months. And then finally, going back to the 2009 low on March 9th, stocks are up 89.7% from that point. So the numbers aren't all that bad, but it sure does feel, you know, a lot worse for investors. And I think a lot of investors are worried that we're headed into another 2008-2009 where you see stocks drop 50%. Greg, why does it feel so bad, and where do we go from here? What's the end game, at least for the next couple months?
Well, I think part of the problem, again, it goes to the spillover from the Eurozone. I mean, this has been in the news for quite a while, and as I've been telling some people, it's if you step back and look at the forest and stop focusing on the trees, you're kind of repeating a pattern here. We thought we had kind of put all that behind us last year because last year we started out very strong. Then Greece came in spring, and everyone was worried about debt, although we felt like our numbers in the U.S. were strong enough. But then we had that correction in August of last year. Looking forward, we had the midterm elections, and then QE2 came out, which provided a little boost to the markets. Again, this 2011 started out fairly strong, but then this whole debt crisis came up again. And, you know, as we just crawled out of the hole from the subprime crisis, I think that, you know, typically investors' memories are very short, but I think that's still fresh enough in their minds because of the severity of that downturn. Then you started out with this, and I think just psychologically people are, all right, I just made it back. I don't want to give it up again. And so they're very gun-shy about being committed to equities. And I think on one of the past calls you had brought up that if people are really that nervous, they really need to re-examine their level of risk, and perhaps they're, you know, again trying to play the markets. But with our economic numbers deteriorating in the U.S., you know, it goes to investor confidence that I think Jeff was alluding to, in that people are going to trade, at least it appears to me that if you look at the numbers, people are just trading on each economic number that comes out. Something that's a little bit positive, we have a good day in the market. Something that comes out, you know, casting a negative light on our potential growth going forward, and we have a sell-off. And I think until we see some kind of a resolution, particularly in Europe, you know, some serious decision-making that deals with that problem, and then obviously we've got our own issues here and see unemployment coming down, I have a feeling we're going to see this volatility for quite a while going forward.
Hello? Did we lose everybody?
We lose everybody?
Oh, I was on mute. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Everyone. John, did you have anything you wanted to add to the stock market commentary by Greg?
Not a great deal, really. You know, valuation is much improved from what it was, not too many months back, you know, given the decline we've had in the market. August was one of the most volatile months in history. This morning early, I found some data that indicated just how volatile it was, and there really haven't been too many comparisons, you know, historically with what happened in August. And that, you know, again, you know, points up, you know, confirms what Greg was talking about in terms of volatility, which, of course, is very confusing. You know, it tends to scare a lot of folks. Because of you know, the volatility is just so extreme, but in a long-term sense, if we assume only moderate growth going forward in a low you know, economic activity environment, you're still looking at pretty decent value in the market at this point. So I'm also reminded of what it was like in the early 1980s. Following that long period of volatility and high inflation in the 1970s. And you had a period in the late 70s, early 1980s, where valuation was, for most of that period, relatively attractive, but it took a few years to really get something significant going as far as the market was concerned. And we may be in that kind of period now where valuation stays good for a while, volatility continues, and we just have to grit our teeth and live through it and recognize that, you know, better times are coming, but as long as the valuation numbers are reasonably decent, you know, we should be in pretty good shape.
Thanks, John. Jeff, you know, one thing that's, I think, has been kind of interesting over the last couple of years, we've seen fears about stagflation. We saw fears about deflation, which eventually led to QE2. Now we have concerns about inflation. The most recent reading on the CPI was 3.6%, which is a bit higher than most anticipated. Is this a short-term blip, or is this a long-term concern?
Well, I can tell you that the long-term inflation forecast by the bond market continue to ratchet down, actually. There was a blip up earlier this year, but the long-term forecasts keep coming down. And we have seen agricultural prices, which is what a lot of people feel the most, they have rolled over and started heading down. The raw materials, even some of the industrial metals have started to soften somewhat. Oil is down, the other one of the major commodities. That's down dramatically. We all see that firsthand. So the commodity stocks, I mean, the raw materials themselves, the raw commodities, have started coming down. Now, a lot of that's in the pipeline, but it's a good chance that what we're seeing right now is probably peak inflation, and that we'll start seeing that come down. Food inflation on the shelf may continue to rise for a couple more months as the as some of the early inflation from earlier this year, the bubble moves through the system. But essentially, it appears that we're seeing the peak right now, and that we should start to see certainly core inflation as well as headline inflation start to move down, and then by the time we get back, get out to 2012, we'll see inflation back down in that lower 2% range. And I think the Fed has said they're fine with anything 2 to 3%. They'd like to see a little bit of inflation in the economy. They don't feel real good about 3.6%, but that's not a long term situation. That's a short term bubble.
Well, I'm looking at the 10-year Treasury right now, and it looks like 1.94% to invest in a 10-year Treasury. So obviously, as you mentioned, the bond market isn't concerned about inflation, and they're not real concerned about the S&P downgrade based on that number. Do you think that we hold that? You know, we've been trading in that right around 2% for a couple weeks now. Do we hold that? Is that kind of the future where we have a 10-year that's around 2%, or are we going to see some volatility in that yield as well?
Well, I think we're likely to see a little bit of volatility. There's probably two factors that come into play there. First of all, there's some flight to quality. The European situation, the concerns in Europe have sent people across the pond here to buy U.S. Treasuries as someplace safe to put their money. And so that's forced interest rates down just a touch. And then of course, the long-term, being the economy being as sluggish as it is, also is serving to push those interest rates down. But we don't really see any long-term pressure for interest rates rising at this point, but there are a couple factors. You know, you could see it rise, I don't know, 25 basis points or something back up near closer to 2%, which would still be very low from a long-term standpoint.
Okay. Looks like I just had a question come in.
While you're reading that, I just thought of one other aspect that may come as part of another question, and that is, what's the Fed going to do? And there is some discussion recently that the Fed may not do a QE3, but may do something where they sell short-term securities and buy 10- and 30-year securities. So that would be an offset to whatever pressure towards higher rates might be out there. So the Fed is looking at that. They're careful, because if they do too much, it might backfire on them in terms of inflationary expectations. But that is, the Fed has a tool in their toolbox to essentially keep that 10-year rate down quite low.
Okay. If anybody has any questions, please email them to David_Lundgren@HancockBank.com. We're running right up on 9:30. Okay. I think we'll go ahead and end the call there. Thank you, everyone, for listening this morning, and we'll talk to you next month. Thank you.